You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Lloyds. The eyes of the cycling world are on Kigali, which is hosting the UCI Road World Championships this week. The Great Britain team competing in Rwanda is sponsored by Lloyds, and that's part of a multi-year partnership between Lloyds and British Cycling, supporting the national team riders as they head towards the Olympic Games in Los Angeles in 2028. It's been a great week in the time trial events, with Team GB's Zoe Baxted winning the women's under 23 time trial title, taking home the rainbow jersey and gold medal, and following up her world title wins at junior level 3 years ago. That was one of a number of top 10 finishes for Team GB riders, because Millie Cousins was 6th in the event that Baxted won, and Callum Thornley was 5th in the men's under 23 time trial. At junior level, the next generation of riders showed that they're making great strides, because there was a 5th place for Max Hines in the men's time trial and a 5th place for Erin Boothman in the women's race, with Abigail Miller also finishing in 8th place. At elite level, Anna Henderson was 8th for Team GB, and all of those Team GB riders are wearing the national colours red, white and blue, with the famous Lloyds horse logo on the front, because Lloyds is there at every stage. Now it's on with this week's episode.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you on September 24th and wishing future 15-time Tour de France champion Paul Sixas a happy 19th birthday. My name is Daniel Freeber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will mainly be discussing the Cycling World Championships in Rwanda, and particularly the men's road race on Sunday. Incidentally, in case anyone was wondering, on the day when the Messiah Sixas emerged into the world, Paolo Bettini won the first of his two rainbow jerseys in Salzburg, Austria, which is highly convenient because Bettini was from Tuscany, specifically a place called La California, and joining us from California is our adopted Tuscan via Denmark and now Liguria, Brian Nygaard, who's recovering from the shock, the aftershock of an earthquake.
I think that's over dramatizing. Yeah, there was a little bit of a tremble just as we were preparing for the episode. I was actually in Salzburg when he won the world. So were you guys, probably.
I was not. But the hills were alive with the Italian national anthem, the Inno di Mammelli, weren't they, that day? Also in the building, of course, today is the Golden State Warrior himself, that being the disunited state of not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel. Hello, Brian. We're reunited for the first time since Naples, the Napoli stage of the Giro d'Italia, which we didn't complete, did we, Daniel?
Speaking of earthquakes.
Let's gloss over that. My mistake. I persuaded you to detour, to drop off my luggage at my hotel near the airport, thinking we could get to the finish in time. We missed it. We missed Caden Groves winning in the rain, didn't we? And we recorded in that little bar. And that's the first time that you and I, Daniel, have been on the podcast together. Since then, of course, we've had the Tour de France, which we've covered separately. You for the TV, me for the podcast. And then, of course, you've been at the Vuelta. I've been at the Tour of Britain. And the three of us back together again for the first time since early May, or mid-May, probably, wasn't it?
Feels like a Atomic Kitten reunion tour.
Wow.
Anyway.
Push the button.
Yeah. Which version of Atomic Kitten? There were several lineup changes, a bit like the Cycling Podcast. Anyway, Lionel, it has been so long since I've done a regular episode, I'd sort of forgotten how we proceed. But we had the new sort of format we'd adopted a few months ago was that instead of the traditional news roundup, generally, mainly because there's too much news nowadays in professional cycling for us to cover it all concisely. We were calling it the newsette, weren't we? The sort of bring and buy, everyone pick a news story from the last week. In this case, it might be a bit longer than a week because we haven't done a regular episode for a while. And we all just sort of meditate on that news story together for a few minutes. Who would like to go first?
Well, I was going to take a spin on the transfer merry-go-round, really, and just recap a couple of the things that have caught my eye over the last few weeks while you've been at the Vuelta, I've been at the Tour of Britain. The one kind of big story of this transfer window, if I can borrow a phrase from football, is the spending spree of the Decathlon team, the French team that is really ramping up. It's kind of, it's doing a sort of Blackburn Rovers 1994 here, isn't it? It's kind of collecting.
And we all know what that means.
Well, Blackburn Rovers went on to win the Premier League title, which Rob Hatch, if he was here, would be punching the air as he's a Blackburn fan. But Decathlon are very active in the transfer window, aren't they? They've signed Tiesj Benoot and Olav Koy from Visma Leasebike. They have signed Matthew Risitello from Israel. And they've also added Robbie Hayes from Alpecin, Case Boll from Astana, Dan Hull from Lidl Trek, and Tobias Lund Andersen from Picnic Post NL. And this feels like the kind of the next phase in this development project that the Decathlon team is basically spending the money that is being poured into the top of the team to try and make them one of the big five in the World Tour. And it's, I feel like this is a sort of the intermediate step towards identifying some, you know, additional riders to really take them onto the next level, or kind of everyone's in a bit of a holding pattern while Paul Seksas kind of finishes playing with his birthday presents and, you know, gets down to business as a, as an actual grown up.
Gets his driver's license.
They haven't actually had a very good season, chaps. And, well, they've had 24 wins, which is respectable, but 3 World Tour wins, which is not great. I remember predicting at the start of the season that they might struggle this year after the great season that they had last year. Mm. And they got rid of a lot of sort of established riders, and they filled the roster with a lot of, well, there was a new intake of a lot of young riders, sort of 21, 22-year-olds. Some of them have done well, some of them have done less well. I don't think they'll be too worried, but it's a formidable lead-out train, certainly for Koy, that they have assembled, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, I mean, I was going to ask you guys, because they're losing Bruno Armerai, who's going the other way to Benoot and Koy. Armerai is going to Visma Leasebike, and he's a good time trialist, isn't he? But I wonder, you know, does Benoot and Koy, I think, gives them more winning power, doesn't it? Koy is going to win stages and will presumably get an opportunity at the Tour de France, which was one of the things that we were talking about at the Tour of Britain when the rumour of the transfer to Decathlon really kind of took off. And he is at that stage where in a team like Visma, Leasebike might find it hard to get into the Tour de France team because of the emphasis on supporting Jonas Vingegaard. But with Decathlon, you know, they're kind of on that trajectory where maybe they want to bank some wins, and Koy may well give them that. You know, he's capable of winning lots of stages, of week-long stage races, and stepping up at the Tour de France. And, one of the other Grand Tours, if selected to do two in the same year, we'll see.
Yeah, I think he'll win. I would suggest he'll be a fairly prolific winner. I don't know where you guys think he currently stands in the sort of hierarchy of sprinters, behind Merlier, probably behind Philipsen, behind Milan, but maybe then the next guy. But armed with that lead out train, he may well he has to sort of prove himself in Grand Tours first, well, in the Tour de France first of all, but he may well move up the ladder, I would suggest, chaps. Of course, that was a team that when they signed Sam Bennett a couple of years ago, and that hasn't worked out particularly well. Anyone who's watched the latest edition of the Netflix series will be, the Netflix documentary series on the Tour de France, will be familiar with how that sort of narrative has gone. But that hasn't worked out too well. He was sort of the first, that was sort of the first time they'd really put any might, any heft behind a sprinter, and it hasn't worked out. But well, yeah, go on, Brian.
No, something that also comes to mind when seeing that and also looking at this revamped, I mean, that's this, I wouldn't say it's a new team because there's a lot of the structure that's the same, but also the change in management and the change in atmosphere was, I know that the Netflix has its caveats with how things are edited and everything, but it was a significant change of mindset in the team management, you could at least say, and that came across quite firmly in the Netflix documentary. It was a different approach to how a team was supposed to be run. And sometimes, I suppose, with coming in now with a bigger new roster, it could be maybe easier for them to go in a certain direction, because it seemed like it was difficult for them to assemble the old part of the team direction, of team leadership into this new way of running the team, where it seemed to me like winning was, as in a lot of sports, is the only thing that really counts. But it seemed like the lack of winning was certainly a bigger problem almost than getting those wins. You know, it was it seemed like they'd actually come to a crossroad, you know, and that's what's the reason why the Lavenue era went to went to an end.
Their declared aim, of course, is to join the kind of super teams, the sort of realm of Visma Leasebike, UAE Team Emirates. And on that note, Brian, would you mind if I go next with my little news item for the week? I decided this week to talk to you chaps about the record the UAE have broken with their 86 wins, courtesy of Brandon McNulty winning the GC, the Tour of Luxembourg. 86, of course, that took them ahead of HTC's 85 wins in 2009. Lionel, you might have some perspective context on this. I was sort of going down what I thought is the kind of all-time ranking. And so we had HTC on 85 in 2009. MAPPE had 81 in 1997. And well, UAE had also had 81 in 2024. But it occurred to me, Lionel, that it was very unlikely to find anyone who would have got anywhere near that, because teams used to be a lot smaller. Squad used to be a lot smaller. Quickstep, of course, had 73 in 2018. They had a long period where they were sort of averaging in the 60s, and they had that 1 year in 2018 where they got 73. And then if you go back to some of the great teams of yesteryear, of yore, FAEMA had 69 wins with only 23 riders in 1970, and Panasonic had 60 wins in 1984. I think the most, this has been pointed out by a lot of people, but the most remarkable thing about UAE this year is that only two of those wins really have come from a bunch sprinter, Molano, whereas with HTC, for example, they had Cavendish, Greipel, Boston Hagen, Greg Henderson even. MAPPE had Jans Ferrada, Tom Steels in 1997. Quickstep had Viviani and Jakobsen in 2018. I'll just run down the wins contributed by each of the individuals.
Wow, this will take all night.
Well, it will, yeah. Pogacar, 16. Del Toro, 12. Almeida, 10. Ayuso, 8. Vine, 5. McNulty, 4. Narvaez, 4. Oliveira, that's Ivo Oliveira, 4. Soler, 3. Morgado, 3. Wellens, 2. Corvi, 2. Molano, 2. Kristen, 2. And Arrieta, Maika, Sivakov, and Adam Yates, all contributing 1 each. Pretty remarkable achievement, isn't it, chaps?
Yeah.
It is. I think 20 of their 29 riders have won a race of some kind this year. I think Groschartner and Micah's victories were national championship titles.
Oh, I didn't mention Groschartner.
If you include the two national championship titles as well, 20 of the 29 riders have won. They did, whether they were being entirely serious, they did a few weeks ago state that the ambition was to try and get every single rider a victory between that point and the end of the season. Going to be tough with weeks running out now, but they really have swept all before them, haven't they? And as you say, Daniel, I mean, I'm thinking back to, I think Lavie Claire had a really good year, one of maybe 84 or 85, but the teams were a lot smaller then, and
they didn't,
you know,
they didn't compete on multiple fronts, did they? You didn't have weeks where the teams would have three teams competing in different places. Occasionally two, but not three, I don't think.
Yeah, and as you say about HTC Colombia, was it, or was a high road at that point, 2009, you know, so much of that was delivered by sprinters coming off, you know, a variation of the same sprint train, all built for Mark Cavendish, but with other riders getting their opportunities as well. And once they got on a roll, they would win multiple stages in, sprint stages in the stage races. But this is completely different, because half of those riders you named, probably two thirds of those riders you named, are climbers. Really, aren't they? They're riders that can win hilly stages, mountain stages, hilly one-day races. And it does feel a bit like they've identified riders on the basis that they can win across as many different types of terrain as possible, and without stacking resources into a lead out train of any kind, because that really uses up resources, doesn't it? Sprinters, yes, but then you need people to deliver them. And as you say, the only notable sprinter is Milano. So yeah, it's sort of changed the way, I think they've kind of changed the way they've looked at the whole season, really. It's been a few years in the making, this. They've kind of, they've got kind of Pogacar at the very top of the pyramid, and then they've really reinforced that pyramid behind him or under him.
At the Vuelta, I did. We were talking about Almeida and how much they were putting behind Almeida, and whether they were putting enough resources behind Almeida, and whether they were prioritizing volume of wins over Almeida. And I said this on the podcast at the time, but I do still wonder it about the financial incentives from the sponsors for certain landmarks in terms of wins. Could it be that there is a significant sort of bounty to be had, a significant bonus to be had for getting to 80 or getting to 90 or getting to 100?
Wouldn't rule it out with that type of sponsorship. One thing worth mentioning also, I mean, they're all, a lot of them, extremely impressive wins. One thing that I really has astonished me is the number of wins that Del Toro has picked up in the last period. It's one thing to be a fantastic climber, but his ability to finish off the job is just astonishing. I mean, that's what he's in the last months he's picked up, what, 8 wins or something like that. It's like a
turbocharged Mark Hirschi.
Yeah, exactly. Like that season, Mark Hirschi was the best that Mark Hirschi's probably ever be. That's just, if it wasn't for him, if it wasn't for any rider who has had 10 plus wins, but him especially, also looking at what's left of the season, depending on what Pog decides to do, there's plenty more wins in him, I think.
Mm-hmm. Brian, from the sublime to the ridiculous, and we're going to talk about wine or vini now, but not your Chardonnay. We're going to talk about an Italian team that used to be called Vini Zabu. I think that's your news item.
Yeah. It came out just randomly browsing through the local media, Daniel, and a police investigation had finished on something that occurred back in 2021. And, you know, some of us remember the positives, the negative of the positives that came out from the riders who turned positive tests from the Vini Zabu in 2021. In particular, Matteo De Bonis, he tested positive for EPO. And who would have thought that would have been possible in 2021 in and out of competition? But out of that came a police investigation that had now finished. And it brought to light something that was a lot more organized than it seemed. So to put it in context, this team has closed now and has been so since 2021. But what this police investigation has covered, has unraveled, is that there was a system of signing riders under the guise of them being having the level of being pro riders, but not really. And then money being brought back into the team that they had to find. And it was basically systematic doping and financial exploitation. And two of these managers have been charged. And the first hearing is on Monday. And I believe 7 riders have been charged as well. So another big blow, albeit in hindsight, but certainly a big blow to Italian cycling and to the credibility of Italian cycling and to also to the potential attractability of Italian cycling sponsorships.
Yeah, so sort of all of the kind of skullduggery that you might, in the worst case scenario, associate with that sort of Italian, well, the worst example of that kind of Italian team in a certain period, sort of all condensed into a single story based on what I've read, Brian. I've read the same reports as you, and seems pretty egregious, pretty flagrant, and pretty, as I say, sort of symptomatic of a certain corner, dark corner of the Italian cycling scene.
Yeah, it should be mentioned that so the last name of the team was Vini Zabu, It has, in other iterations, been called Esti Neri, Farnese Vini Neri Sottoli, Villa Trestina, Vini Fantini Sell'Italia. So it had a tenure between 2009 and 2021. So fairly long presence in Italian cycling, and a certain number of Giros written, etc., and quite a few wins also along the way. But certainly a black page in the history of Italian cycling once again.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Saily, a new eSIM service. It's an app brought to you by the creators of NordVPN, and it can help you to keep your roaming costs down when you're traveling outside your own country, because it's an affordable eSIM with data plans to cover more than 200 destinations. With a Saily eSIM, you'll always have a connection when you need one as well. How does it work? Well, instead of going to the airport when you arrive and buying a local SIM, you don't have to buy anything physical. You just download the eSIM app once on your device, and then you subscribe to the global or regional plan that covers the area that you're going to be in. So it saves you time. It's simple, it's easy, it's secure, and it can save you money because the roaming charges can be reduced significantly, and it will save you mobile data because Saily's built-in ad blocker stops browser ads from loading, and that can reduce your data usage by up to 28%. The Saily eSIM is brought to you by the creators of NordVPN, so you know that it's secure as well. If you download the Saily app from your app store and use the code cycling at checkout, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. So search Saily, that's S-A-I-L-Y, in your app store, or go to saily.com/cycling for details.
Well, chaps, that deals with some of the sort of subplot side stories that have been going on, rumbling along alongside the main event of what this week, certainly, that is the World Championships in Rwanda. Long anticipated World Championships, the first ones in or on the continent of Africa. And, well, they started with shock, didn't they, chaps? A big upset, I would suggest. An upset, well, this is the first point to address, really. Because I had been sort of out of the loop a little bit last week. I was on holiday in Portugal, in Spain, having a great time. And I sort of, when I tuned back in on the weekend, I was sort of struck by how confident people seem to be in social media that Tadej Pogacar was going to win the World Time Trial Championship on Sunday and that he was going to beat Remco Evenepoel. And this was largely based on the course, the elevation profile of the course in Kigali on Sunday. What occurred? Well, as most of the listeners will know by now, Remco Evenepoel won the World Time Trial Championship again. That was the third straight victory, wasn't it? Three in a row. And not only did he win, but he trounced Pogacar, who was fourth. And Lionel is going to tell us who's finished second and third.
Well, Remco won convincingly ahead of Jay Vine, who was 1 minute 14 seconds back. Jay Vine of Australia, of course. And then Ilan Van Wilder, Remco Evenepoel's Belgian compatriot, was third, 2:36. And then Pogacar just missing out on a medal at 2:37. Ahead of his, UAE Team Emirates teammate, Isaac Del Toro of Mexico, in fifth place. But it was the sight of Pogacar being caught by Remco Evenepoel on that cobbled climb that was really, well, it's a picture so far of the World Championships, isn't it? Because we've not seen Pogacar really be dealt that kind of blow. Evenepoel was closing in on him with over 6 kilometres to go and finally drew level and went past him with, I think, sort of 2.1 kilometres to go. And then there was a kind of the slightly humbling sight of Pogacar riding directly in Evenepoel's slipstream, which is not technically allowed, is it, when you've been caught in a individual time trial like that. But it must have been quite a sort of humbling moment for Pogacar, because at that point he'd been caught for 2.5 minutes by the only rider who set off on the road behind him, the defending champion Remco Evenepoel. And it's one of those ones, really. I think, you know, Remco Evenepoel was obviously very good, but today Pogacar was obviously, you know, off what we probably would have expected. I'm not saying that I thought he would definitely win, but I thought he would definitely get a medal. I think it's the fact that he finished fourth that was more of the shock for me. Even perhaps than being caught by Evenepoel for 2.5 minutes.
What did you chaps think in general about what I just described? That this was certainly the impression that I had. The feeling I had was that there was a bit of a groundswell, a bit of a consensus that Pogacar, well, I think this was borne out by the bookmakers' odds, that he was the favourite, which to me was completely inconsistent with his previous results in championship time trials, because he's never won one. He's never won a European championship. He's never won a world championship. And in fact, well, I'll maybe discuss it in a minute, his previous results, but he's never really come close. And okay, it did seem to be a hilly time trial course. I think 800 metres of climbing, which doesn't sound a lot, but over 40, was it 40 kilometres or 47? 40 kilometres. That is significant. But nonetheless, I was quite taken aback by this feeling that he would definitely beat Remco.
I'm thinking also when you look at the preparation that Emco had compared to Pogacar, who in the right mind would put Pogacar over Evenepoel as a favourite for this?
There were these quotes, weren't there, Brian? There were quotes from Pogacar where he talked about, and again, I'm not sure quite the context of what he said when he said it exactly, but he talked about having ridden more on his time trial bike than was usual for him. And I think people assumed from that, read into that, that he had prepared perfectly. And it was only afterwards that he obviously, with the benefit of hindsight,
right,
he then started talking about actually all of the issues and the setbacks that he had in his build-up, and the fact that he'd missed a week of training and he'd not been able to complete some of those sessions. But certainly that wasn't the mood music that I saw reported going into Sunday's race.
I'm also thinking it's not giving Evenepoel a lot of credit for what he's actually achieved.
No.
And when you think of it, you know, now being triple world champion, but also Olympic champion, and even in the Tour, the only one who's consistently able to beat Pogacar in those 3 weeks where Pogacar is actually at his very best. The only surprise for me, he's 1 second off a medal, Pogacar, so that's, he might as well had gotten a medal. The surprise for me is the time gap. That's the only real surprise. And it's hard for me to see that as a reflection of Pogacar's current form, because what we saw in the second race in Canada would not suggest that at all. So the explanatory engine behind that would have to be an off day or something along the lines. And he did mention in the interview, though, the post-race interview Pogacar did, that he had he been ill in a period?
Before Canada, I think.
Yeah, and that had meant that his time trial by time had been reduced. I would still say that Pogacar in peak form would still be able to lose less time than that. But having him as a favorite over Remco Evenepoel in a world championship, what are the data that would support that?
But I think wasn't that because, as Daniel says, it was a hilly course, a lot of climbing involved. You're absolutely right. I mean, his past record in world championship individual time trials is not spectacular. His previous best result, sixth in Australia in 2022, only 21st in Scotland in 2023, when he then went on and got a bronze medal in the road race. So it's not been his speciality, this kind of standalone time trial event. He's obviously very good at time trials in the Tour de France, but I don't even think he's a nailed on time trial winner in those circumstances, as we saw in the last couple of editions of the Tour de France where Remco Evenepoel was beating him. Whereas Evenepoel's record in these type of time trials is exemplary. As you say, three in a row at the World Championships. He won the Olympic Games time trial in Paris in very impressive fashion. He looked really good at the Tour of Britain. I know it's not, you know, a huge race, but he won a stage there. And in the past, it's proved to be quite a good warm-up for the World Championship, just because of the type of effort it is and the distance it is from when the World Championships is held. Whereas Pogacar's time since the Tour de France, he went over to Canada, where obviously He did the 1-2 with his teammate Brandon McNulty in the second of those races, but you know, wasn't really a factor in the first of the two. So a lot of time flying around. Will have flown from Europe to Canada and then back and then over to Africa as well. So I think the surprise was the sight of him being caught and the time gap, as you say. But fourth is still his best result in a World Individual Time Trial Championship.
And I mean, I tweeted at the weekend the
saw those interesting
time. Yeah, the time per seconds per kilometre he's lost in those championship time trials, Worlds, Europeans, and well, 2023 Worlds. Lionel, you mentioned it was the same 3.9. Seconds a kilometre that he lost to the winner there, and it was similar at the Europeans in 2021. So I think probably more questions than answers.
Got to bear in mind also, it was his 27th birthday on Sunday, so maybe he had the cake and the jelly and the ice cream before he went for warm up. And
jelly,
then, you got it all wrong.
I thought they get those like in little things they squeeze out during competition, the jellies. But also, I mean, Evenepoel came to Kigali with one specific achievable certain goal, and that was to become the time trial world champion. And he had prepared for that, I think, above and beyond. He's going to be a factor, and Belgium is going to be a factor in the road race, but that was Evenepoel's sure shot goal, I think, not Pogacar's. Everything else being equal, I think Evenepoel had that as a very, very big goal, less so Pogacar.
Yeah, and a lot of things to do well with the conditions, acclimatization. We'll talk about those in relation to the road race as well, altitude, air quality. When they respectively arrived as well, that might have been a consideration, or certainly the fact that Pogacar only arrived, I think, a couple of days before the time trial, that may have been an issue. But chaps, some other notable performances, more, I would say, sort of overperformers than underperformers, although there were a few of the latter as well, but Jay Vine finishing second, not really a surprise given how well he has been time trialing of late and those two stage wins at the Vuelta, and also how well he time trialed at the Vuelta. And more surprising was Ilan Van Wilder in third place. Not a bad time trialist by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly, and well, certainly based on his stature as well, if you've ever stood next to Ilan Van Wilder, you wouldn't necessarily pick him out as an expert time trialist. You wouldn't pick Remco Evenepoel out as an expert time trialist just based on his stature either. But Ilan Van Wilder, even less so. He's got sort of broader shoulders, and I think he's even a couple of centimetres shorter. And him finishing third did suggest that it was a bit of an abnormal, anomalous time trial. You know, what we were saying about people thinking it would suit Pogacar more, suiting a climber more. Well, that was sort of borne out by Van Wilder finishing third.
Yeah, it was a kind of Grand Tour rider's time trial, wasn't it? Rather than, it wasn't a time trialist time trial. I mean, Stefan Kung just about in the top 10, 3 minutes 48 behind Remco Evenepoel. I know he's not quite as good as he has been in the past.
Yeah, but he's had a bad summer. I mean, we spoke to him at the Vuelta about his time trial. He's not, he hasn't felt good since the Tour of Poland. I wasn't that surprised by that.
No, but again, we're clutching at threads here to put into context, because it's not like there's a, you know, there wasn't a Filippo Ganna there to see, you know, how a pure time trialist might have got on a course like that, for example. You know, Luke Plapp is, again, he's a rider that copes very well with undulation. So it was an unusual one. And I mean, you know, Remco Evenepoel, you know, no doubt the best on the day and one of the biggest winning margins in world time trial history.
But I mean, isn't,
in the men's elite race.
Isn't the discussion, I suppose, that grew out of it, or the upset, is more, it's not, let's say if we took away the time gap and just, Evenepoel beat Pogacar, it's because it then sets in motion the speculation that Pogacar would then not be the favorite for the road race on Sunday. That's what it's, I think it's sort of brought along. And that's where I would say I don't take that as any kind of consequence for how I think he's going to fare in the road race. I don't think it's a reflection of the type of legs he'll have on the start line going into the road race. I don't think so, at least.
Is Pogacar washed?
Yeah,
career over for the Slovenian.
27 years of age and done.
That was the moment when it happened.
Well, chaps, we are going to hear from someone. We're not going to hear from Tadej Pogacar, although he will be speaking to the media tomorrow. We're going to hear from someone who's in Rwanda in just a second, but I'm just looking over Elan van Wilder's previous time trial results. And Sunday was his best ever result in any individual time trial since he turned professional in 2021. So that was quite remarkable. Anyway, chaps, as promised, we are not in Rwanda, but several of our colleagues, not the usual sort of contingent of journalists who would go to world championships, because it has been, well, it's quite expensive. It has proven quite expensive to go to Rwanda, but some of our colleagues are there. One of them is a long time sort of friend, colleague, and we've shared many adventures with him over the last few years since the Slovenians really have held sway. I'm talking about David Chumil of Slovenian National Television, not to be confused with Sergio Chumil, the Guatemalan who we met at the Vuelta, or Andrej Chmiel, who we also discussed in relation to. None of them are related, although it is quite an extraordinary coincidence that you've got three surnames, which I should look into the etymology of the three respective surnames. Completely different spellings, but
Andrej Chmiel has been spelled in many a way.
Well, and he's represented five, it was at last count, countries. So between them, seven countries and one surname that sounds pretty much the same. Anyway, here's David Chmiel. I spoke to him this morning. He is in Rwanda, and he gave me his impressions of the country so far and also his impressions of Tadej Pogacar's ride on Sunday.
Yeah, we came here on Friday late in the evening. So, it's hard to say it's good, it's bad, but As far as I know, as I found out in those couple of years that we're traveling a lot now, it depends on you, on yourself, whether it's good or bad. So if you come here in a good mood and it doesn't bother you too much that everything is different, then for you it's okay. But since the beginning, since arriving on the airport and so on, everything is really smooth, you know. I think at the moment, I hope I'm not wrong, but I think at the moment they are interested in this because it's a big show. It's something big here, you know. It doesn't matter whether it's cycling or not. It's just sort of a big thing here, as much as the sports, as much as, you know, as we're talking about a big sporting event. Mm. It doesn't matter if it's cycling or not. So they are around, they are in the streets and so on. But, you know, if I would say that they know a lot about cycling, it's not like in Europe, definitely not. But at the end of the day, it wasn't much different maybe in Australia where we were. It wasn't like there would be something more and more and more. So it is crowded. There's a lot of people, you know, coming to races. Today I went running and then I stopped in the on the race route and waited for riders to come. And there was really a lot of people already in 8 o'clock, huh? 8 o'clock. So they come to the roadside and they cheer. And okay, I was waiting for a Slovenian team, but they were cheering for everybody. You know what I mean? The group of people that was there, they've had drums and flags and everything, and they were really cheering, but they didn't notice Remco Evenepoel coming up. They didn't notice Isaac Del Toro coming on that uphill, you know, and they were going slowly. They were cheering for everyone. So I think the culture is different, but people are there, even though they might not know as well those cyclic stars. On the other hand, I don't know, when Tadej went up there, there were 30 riders around him taking pictures and so on during the recon. So the riders know, even if they are from Rwanda or Haiti, the ocean.
David, you mentioned that you went running this morning. I understand from other people who are on the ground and who I've been speaking to that the air quality is maybe a bit of an issue.
I think so. I don't know how there are people that think 1,500 meters above sea level, it's not the high altitude and it doesn't change. But I'd be guessing that when I come here, my heart rate would be, you know, very high. But it isn't. You just can't go, right? You know, you just can't run as good as you are used to, maybe as fast as you are used to, because I don't know, it's difficult to breathe. And I don't know. I'm not sure that it's because of the altitude or something. I think it's more of the pollution in the air.
Mm.
When the sun is shining and everything, I don't know, you don't have the feeling that you see really far, far away. You see it, but maybe, I don't know, then when I look at the camera shots, you know, it's not polluted like in some towns, let's say, around the world. But you got that feeling that it's tough, huh? It's tough to breathe.
And David, so just a couple of questions about the Slovenians and the races this week, well, particularly the road race at the weekend, and then also looking back at the time trial. What did you make of Pogacar's time trial? And I guess you've been around the Slovenian camp and you will have been able to gauge their reaction, both Tadej's reaction and also the staff, the entourage. What was your feeling about the time trial at the weekend?
To tell you the truth, I'm a few kilometers away and I've been on Sunday, I've been around, of course, but then after, you know, it's not that they do a lot of, I don't know, press things, you know, to do. And so you don't get a lot of information. As I saw it at the end, he was really disappointed even for that second, you know. He really wanted even to be hurt, you know, because, I don't know, we're always saying, win is the only thing that is interesting. But, you know, so... that only means that he's motivated still. And yeah, for the road race, I think it's going to be totally different. It's one day. The time trial is one day and not less than an hour of effort.
Yeah. Historically, he's also done pretty, I won't say badly, but his performances in one day championship time trials have been pretty mediocre, certainly compared to the rest of his career.
On Saturday before the time trial, I asked him something like, okay, the last time trial you did in Australia, and then he corrected me. No, actually it was Glasgow, and it's better to forget it. Something like this, you know.
But
then on the other hand, you know, last year on the road race, it was a different story. And even though if you look at it like this, this is the best time trial he had in world championships. He mentions a lot that he didn't prepare well because of the illness before the Montreal, I think, before the Canada.
Mm.
So maybe it's that, but I don't know. I think the road race will be totally different. And
yeah, it should be interesting. Sounds like you're having an interesting experience. Oh, one more thing I was going to ask you. Have you eaten or drunk anything interesting yet? I saw some of our Danish colleagues had been learning about Rwandan coffee, and that looked pretty interesting. But have you eaten and drunk or drunk anything interesting yet?
Eaten not that much of a different kind of food than, let's say, in Europe. I'm still maybe gathering the courage to do it.
Right.
But about the coffee, amazing dude. To tell you, I like drinking, I don't know, the coffee in Italy.
Yeah.
In France, I used to avoid coffee, let's say like this, but in Italy, I like to drink it. It's true. And here, it's almost the same. Huh? To order the cappuccino, it's amazingly good.
Well, chaps, we will get on to more Pogacar speculation, conjecture later in the episode there, having heard from David. But we also heard his impressions, his first impressions of Rwanda there. And of course, this is the World Championships that has, well, it's sort of been the subject of a fairly intense debate, some kind of hand-wringing, some misgivings about whether the World Championship should be in Rwanda in the first place for reasons we might touch on. I think most people would agree that Africa, well, it's long overdue for Africa to have World Championships, but already we've seen a little bit in the time trial events with the mixed relay. Today we've seen enough through our sort of TV screens for our kind of maybe preconceptions to be molded, changed, confronted with some sort of taste of what's happening over there. One thing, Brian, I know that you've been privy to this, you've seen a bit of this, a bit of debate on social media, particularly a corner of the Italian cycling internet, about the time trial at the weekend and the disparities in the equipment. Obviously, so at this World Championship, not all of the teams who had qualified, the nations that had qualified, have taken either their full allocation of riders or indeed have gone at all. There are some countries who have decided not to go at all, mainly for financial reasons, though that might not be the case in all instances.
Denmark for financial reasons.
For some teams, I don't think it worked out logistically, or they decided to put their resources elsewhere. But anyway, this has, and if you look at the UCI qualification criteria, this basically it opens up the opportunity for the places to be reallocated. The UCI can also invite countries, a certain number of countries, to every World Championship, sort of wild cards, which they've done. And some of the places have been reallocated. And so we had probably a wider representation, a sort of wider range of countries represented already at the races that we've seen, and we'll see that again on Sunday. I've just got the numbers here. The UCI has been talking about the numbers, particularly of African riders. 33.6% of participants in the World Championships as a whole, so all the events, will come from Africa, and 36 African countries are expected to compete. And yes, what we did see, chaps, very clearly highlighted straight away, was the great disparity in equipment between the competitors, the various competitors in the time trial on the weekend. And we saw that reflected also in the performances, as you would expect. Big, big time caps. The riders who was finishing last in the time trial at the weekend, sort of 43 minutes down. I think Remco's overall time was around 40 minutes, and some of the riders at the back of the field were sort of 40 minutes down. Now, is this embarrassing? As we've seen, well, Brian, you and I have heard suggestions that the UCI should have intervened to make sure this didn't happen, to make sure that some of the African riders or riders from lowlier nations, there are other, for example, riders, I think from the West Indies, for example, should they have been helped to a greater extent? To give them equipment which would take them up to, you know, the sort of parity, not parity, but give them a better chance against their more moneyed competitors from other countries. What do you think?
First of all, I think yes, but also this is a logistically a very different situation than any other worlds, and that's also the reason why those extended wildcards were reshuffled. I don't think necessarily the full picture. I don't think that the lack of their equipment level is the same as saying that they disrespect their possibilities to compete on an equal level. Could they have done more? Yes. Should they have done more? Yes. The circumstances around the logistics of that World Championships and how the UCI operate in that context that I am not aware of. But if they have not given the possibilities to other people, other teams, bike sponsors, equipment suppliers to actually help, and that I'm not aware of, so it's hard for me to really say whether UCI have gone the whole nine yards to really establish that type of equipment to being actually passed around. Because if they haven't done that, then I don't think they've done a good enough job. I don't think the UCI has a full warehouse of state-of-the-art equipment that they could just put in a container and send to Kigali. But I would say, though, if they knew the sizes and if they knew the equipment they needed and if they knew the level of exposure, I don't think there would be bike sponsors who would say no if they were asked, would you be able to assemble X amount of equipment and have it available for these sizes, for these athletes? I don't think anyone would say no. But if they weren't given the possibility, how would they be able to help?
Yeah, I do think it's useful in showing up, well, and really kind of shining a light on the huge disparity and what a huge problem there is. I remember it brought to my mind the day when Biniam Gamai won in Turin, and his direct sportif, Intermarché direct sportif, Eike Visbeek, gave some great interviews at the finish line that day at the Tour de France. I'm talking about in 2024, sorry. And he said, look, you know, this is a great story. It's fantastic. Everyone's going to sort of rejoice and everyone in Eritrea is going to be thrilled about this. But it shouldn't obscure the fact that it's getting harder and harder, not easier. The gap is not being closed. It's getting harder and harder for these athletes to make it to Europe and be competitive in Europe because so much money is being invested at the top of the sport in Western Europe, where it's always been invested in professional cycling. And that leads to a widening in the gulf of opportunities. And I think that Sunday reflected that, didn't it? It showed what an uphill, literally uphill, figuratively uphill task battle these riders are facing.
Yeah, I mean, the International Cycling Center that the UCI has established and the initiatives they have, they're certainly not the you can't rely on that to just be the only thing that should put in motion the careers of these young riders. It takes a lot more than that. And I don't think the disparity and the quality difference in both the performance and the technical abilities they had to establish that performance in the time trial, that's not going to help in any way, shape or form, because it just shows the gap. But I just think that specific situation that we're talking about with the equipment and all, of course that could have been done differently. But when you look at it from a team's perspective, because we are really ultimately, also you mentioning that win in Turin, we are talking about ultimately their possibilities to become professional riders. The teams have a big responsibility in that, right? They are the ones who want to go out and seek potential riders. There's a reason why, you know, coming back to our old friend, you know, speaking of Turin, sometimes you have to go way out of your way to find new talent. You have to go to places in Ecuador and Venezuela and Mexico. There's a reason why Del Toro was discovered. There's a reason why other riders from South America were discovered. It takes teams to go out and seek riders in far away places. I just don't think the World Championships like that in a time trial like that, or you know, there's no way this unfound talent will not be come to light in this World Championships, right? It's a completely different way of finding talent than just looking at the World Championships, because those are not obvious talents. It is, you start at a way younger age and it's a completely different way of sourcing or finding young riders than seeing them in this type of environment, for sure.
But isn't from the UCI's point of view, the reason to have the World Championships in Africa, in Rwanda, is to just turn things on the quarter turn to the next level? It's about attracting eyeballs to the sport. It's about opening, expanding awareness of the sport of cycling. And yes, coming from, in some cases, a very low level, in the short term, would there have been any benefit to the athletes who were taking part in giving them, you know, a bike they were unfamiliar with, you know, in a position that they were unfamiliar with, because it was, you know, top-notch, state-of-the-art equipment that the elite World Tour riders are using? I think in the short term, there wouldn't have been a great deal of benefit to that in terms of the results and performances. But the picture is much bigger than that. It's about showing that cycling does not have to be a an overwhelmingly white sport dominated by a larger number of countries than it was in the 70s and 80s and even 90s. But this is expanding awareness of cycling to another part of the world. There are already stage races in Africa. There's the Tour of Rwanda, which is one of the biggest. That attracts huge crowds. And so it's about the building blocks. It isn't necessarily about talent spotting one of the riders who finished in, you know, the 30s or 40s in the men's elite time trial and saying maybe they could have a stagiaire contract this year or next year. Mm. But it's about sort of spreading the word of cycling. And in some of the African nations where athletics, for example, is currently very popular, presenting cycling as an alternative sport. The big barrier is obviously the cost, because the equipment is expensive. Putting on races in Africa is we know from Stephen Moon, who's been involved in some initiatives at grassroots level, challenging, and the travel as well is difficult. So there's so many hurdles that are not going to be cleared in one jump, but this is about exposing Africa to another level, an elite level of cycling event. And it's about just showing a different face to what professional cycling could look like. And when you look back at the World Championships in the past, I think back to the World Championships in Colombia in 1995, which came after a wave of riders from Colombia had made a huge impact in the Tour de France in the 80s. You know, it can't be a World Championships if it doesn't visit all parts of the world, over a number of years. So I think the benefits will be borne out in future generations, as long as the UCI continues its commitment to investing in cycling in Africa. And as you say, talent spotting, yes, giving opportunities via the UCI Cycling Centre, which, as you say, Daniel, has done a great job of taking people and giving them an opportunity to make a career in professional cycling in Europe, which, you know, is still going to be the kind of the heartland of where the sport takes place for the foreseeable, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's obviously going to be a very difficult question to answer, the question of whether the means... And there's been a lot of scrutiny about this on this World Championships, and lots of discussions about sport washing. Does that means justify the end of promoting the sport in Africa? Well, and in Rwanda specifically, that's really a moot point, isn't it? I think, but definitely, Lionel, in terms of what we had the discussion before we started recording today, when you do start reading about, well, you know, to use the word that has been used, sports washing, or soft power. And as I said, there are lots of misgivings about this random World Championship, but it was certainly in terms of legacy, in terms of having a sort of an effect that is positive, both in the eyes of the whichever government is organising the event or is hosting the event, but also the sport itself, results are much more effective than sponsorship. We usually talk about sports washing in terms of sponsorship, and I do think there will be a positive legacy of this. Whatever the ethics, whatever the reasons why Paul Kagame, the leader of the Prime Minister of Rwanda, why whatever the reason that they've chosen to hold the World Championships, I do think there is a chance of a really positive legacy. And, you know, as we also said before we were recording, the photos, the videos we've seen so far of young Rwandans riding alongside the likes of Tadej Pogacar, cheering, getting excited, you know, it's difficult not to be moved by that, particularly, as we said, bearing in mind the history of this sport, which is kind of shamefully parochial, the history of this sport, and continues to be shamefully parochial. It is really, with a few blips, it's still Western European sport, you know, with the odd kind of smattering of support and representation elsewhere. Australia still largely sort of, capillaries of the sport that have been created by that Western European power centre. It's still sort of Europeans that have gone to the United States and started things there, or Australia, and it all comes back to Western Europe. So that needed to change, didn't it?
I think on that, you, I mean, this is maybe not to be provocative, but also on that note, we probably also can't wait until every single African country meets every single European standard for democracy and free speech for us to actually have any kind of competition there. It's controversial to say that, but it is actually the case, because if we were to wait for to tick every single box in every single category, there's a lot of places we couldn't either find sponsorship or ride bikes or produce every single part that went into a carbon fiber bike. So there's a lot of things where we, I mean, this one thing you can say about sports washing and all of these things as well, it does sometimes, and we've seen that also now with what happened at the World, it does bring at least a lot of questions to the forefront, and questions that will then be discussed, and then that, and will then divide opinions, in the same way that opinions will be divided around Paul Kagame, who is obviously a controversial figure. But it certainly doesn't hide it. It certainly doesn't mean that those, you know, speculations will be muted. And I think that's a good thing about the discussions around sports washing, that at least, you know, it's not, they aren't being silenced.
Yeah, and again, a bit like we mentioned in the Vuelta a España, it's also this World Championship is also the incentive for all of us, and maybe even for riders taking part in the World Championships at the weekend, to read up and find out about why people do use terms like sports washing, and, you know, find out about the genocide, find out about Kagame, who I erroneously refer to as the Prime Minister. He's actually the president of Rwanda. He's also an Arsenal fan who tweets about Arsenal, and has on occasion he's tweeted about, you know, the sort of Arsenal stodgy midfield and how the strikers are a disgrace. Anyway, Lionel's got his head
just
in his hands.
Just as Lionel, we thought, he was controversial, and now even more so.
Yeah. Can I mention just a couple of slightly more curious or light-hearted things before we, in the third part, focus on matters on the road in this World Championship and the road race on Sunday. I talked about this sort of reallocation of places and some of the more curious sort of teams that will be represented in the road race, particularly on Sunday. The one name that really caught my eye, well, name of a country, first of all, because I'd never heard of this country, Nauru. Have either of you two heard of the country Nauru? It's the smallest country, the third smallest country in the world. It's the smallest completely independent republic, I believe. It's in the South Pacific Ocean. It's supposedly the least visited country in the world. It's about 5 kilometers by 4 kilometers, shaped like a sort of kidney bean. It's got two hotels, completely unique language, apparently not really related to any of the languages of the spoken in the islands around there or the countries around there. Most obese country per capita in the world. The currency is the Aussie dollar, but they have a representative on Sunday, and his name, good Nauru, I don't know if that's the adjective, Nauruan name, Valerio Alessandri, born in Locarno, 40 years old. Now, I've set all of my sort of moles and best information sources in Switzerland and various other places onto the case today, because no one knows anything about this guy. There is nothing about him on the internet. He doesn't seem to have an Instagram account. He doesn't seem to have a Strava account. No one knows anything about Valerio Alessandri, who will be competing for Nauru on Sunday. Can either of you two enlighten me?
Obviously not. But yeah, that's a follow-up mark next to that name.
So many questions. The Tour of Nauru, presumably quite a short race if the island's only 4 kilometers.
With one big favorite.
It sounds like, is it not one of those invented islands? What's the island on Zwift? I've never done Zwift. What's that called? It could be. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention, slightly more serious, David and other riders who have already arrived in Rwanda, in Kigali, have talked about the air quality or the strange sort of sensation they have that they can't really breathe as well as they normally can, and their heart rate is high, particularly high or low. The air quality, indeed, I did a bit of a semi-deep dive into this earlier today, and indeed this is sort of borne out by statistics. takes the AQI, which is sort of air quality index. The average is generally sort of in the high 90s, which is poor, very poor. I looked at a league table, chaps, earlier today of the worst cities in the world. In 2024, 94 out of the top 100 are in India. Kigali was 512th out of, I think, 5,000 something. Monaco, incidentally, home of Tadej Pogacar, was the 3,489th worst city in the world. Its average AQI was 36, which was good.
But it deserves, deserves mention, sorry, Daniel. I mean, it is somewhat in altitude, right? I mean, Kigali is what, 1,600
meters? Yeah, 1,500 meters. September also seems to be the worst month for air quality in Kigali consistently. So there you go, chaps. We will talk in the next part about Tadej Pogacar, unless Lionel, you'd like to add
something. I just thought we should wrap up the other elite time trials so far, shouldn't we? Because the women's elite time trial was won by Marlen Rousset of Switzerland. And I mean, she's got a real kind of, I would say love-hate relationship with the individual time trial at the World Championships. Probably remember 2 years ago in 2023, she'd been part of the Swiss team at the mixed relay. And then 2 days later, she quit the women's time trial midway through. She was 33 seconds or so down on the eventual winner, Chloe Dygert, at the first check, but then didn't make it to the second check. And she cited kind of mental and physical burnout. However, she did come back a few days later to finish fourth in the road race. And there was a lot of publicity about, you know, Rousset pulling out of a time trial in the middle. And she said, you know, I'm not a machine. Last year with the Olympic Games, in the summer, the big target, she suffered from long COVID and missed the whole of the second half of the season. No Giro, no Tour de France Femme, Olympics or World Championships. And this year has been a good season for her. She's been second at the Vuelta, won the Tour de Suisse, second in the Giro, quit the Tour de France Femme on the opening stage with a stomach illness. But finally, the day after her 34th birthday, she won the gold medal and rainbow jersey in the individual time trial, having twice been second before in 2020 and 21, and third in 2022. And Rousset was on the podium again today, third place for the Swiss team in the mixed relay, which was won by Australia. Their team of Brodie Chapman, Amanda Spratt, and Felicity Wilson-Haffenden for the women, and Jay Vine, Luke Plapp, and Michael Matthews for the men. They beat the French by just 5 seconds. Michael Matthews is back, isn't he, after a health scare in the summer. He won the one-day race in Frankfurt at the start of May and then went to a training camp at altitude where he started to have difficulties breathing, and he was diagnosed with a possible pulmonary embolism and took a break from racing and training. Came back in August at the Breton Classic where he was eighth and on the podium today, getting a rainbow jersey and gold medal. So hopefully that means that those difficulties are behind him.
So Lionel, Bryant, to the main event of this podcast. Not the main event of the week, because all of the events are equally important. But certainly for the purposes of this podcast, we are on the last part of this podcast. We're going to be focusing on Sunday's men's elite road race. Of course, Tadej Pogacar defending his title. But now we've established a spent force and they'll never win anything again. Who is going to win? We shall discuss that in just a moment. But chaps, the other big sort of... Well, the headline already that has been attached to this, or the strap line, I suppose, has been attached to this World Championships, is the hardest World Championships ever. And that is mainly based on the amount of climbing. Now, this is a real black box, chaps, trying to find out the amount of climbing. Even for Sunday's edition, you know, you can consult three different sources and get three different, quite significantly diverging numbers. I've seen 6,096 meters of climbing. I've seen sort of 5,500 meters of climbing. It is very hilly, but My comment there about it being a bit of a black box, that certainly applies to past editions. Lionel, the one that people sort of hold up as the hardest one ever, was it Duitama in Colombia, which I think you might have already mentioned in this episode. That was at altitude, and it was around about 5,319 meters was one figure I saw. Widely considered to be the hardest, certainly in recent years. The Nürburgring.
I think in the modern sort of era, the last 50 years, I now consider to be the modern era. But if you go back to sort of the early 80s, I think the two that really stand out are that one in 95, Duitama, as you say, won by Abraham Alano of Spain ahead of Miguel Indurain and Marco Pantani, wasn't it? I think on the podium. Only 20 riders finished that race. But again, the start list was, for the time, similar to probably what we'll see on Sunday, not perhaps as deep as you would expect in a Tour de France or a World Championships held in Europe. The other one is 1980 in Sallanches, which, again, I think there were only 15 finishers when Bernard Hinault won, and the time gaps after Hinault were significant. I've seen written that that was over 6,200 meters of climbing, because they did that circuit with some ridiculous number of, it was like something like 28 times up the climb, which has featured in the Tour de France in recent years as well. So that really
will be again on the world circuit.
That's right, Brian. Yes. When it's held in the Haute-Savoie region. Yeah, I think the three ingredients that will make it hard are the altitude, as you say, the lowest point of the course, I think, is 1,500 meters. For historical reference, Duitama at 2,500 meters in Colombia. The other really high one in the last, what I'm calling the modern era, Colorado Springs in 1986 was 1,800 meters as well. So this is a high altitude world, significant amount of climbing, probably is going to be around 5,500 meters of climbing, and also a field that is not going to be as deep as you might expect. So the resources amongst the big teams are going to be spread pretty thin from probably the sort of midpoint of the race, really starting to shred down, the size of the field, less protection in the bunch, all of those factors. It could be one of those races where we're looking at, you know, a couple of dozen riders really in contention going into the last, you know, two, three laps.
We should maybe just tell the listeners how the race is sort of configured, how those laps are configured, because it's not just a circuit race. So to start off, well, there are nine laps of a 15-kilometer circuit, 15.1 kilometers. How does that sort of look? Well, it starts with a bit of a descent. Then there's the Kigali Gulf climb, the mythical Kigali Gulf climb, 800 meters, 8.1%, and that's sort of 8.5 kilometers from the finish line. Then we've got the Côte de Kimihurura, 1.3 kilometers, 6.3%, and that was the cobbled climb that you saw in the time trial, and that starts 2.5 kilometers from the finish line of the lap. And at the end of that climb, the road continues really to go uphill. Always continues on a plateau. The final kilometer of the main lap is 4% uphill. So nine times around that 15-kilometer circuit. Then there's sort of a different part of the race that starts with the Côte de Péage, 1.8 kilometers at 5.9%, followed by Mount Kigali, which is the biggest climb, by far the biggest climb, highest and longest climb in the world or on the route, 5.9 kilometers at 6.9%. Then most of you will have seen pictures in the past of the Mur de Kigali, the Kigali Wall. That isn't one of the main climbs in this world, but it does feature. There is one ascent of the Mur de Kigali, which is 400 meters at 11%. And then, so after this sort of middle portion, and I should say that Mount Kigali, the summit is 107 kilometers from the finish line, then they return to the original lap. And we have six laps of that circuit. that they did 9 times at the start of the race. So chaps, lot of climbing. It looks a bit like an Amstel Gold race, but with the addition of that real sort of, I guess it's going to be 5.9 kilometers, 6.9%. Is it going to be about a 20-minute climb in the middle with 107 kilometers to go, as I said, from the summit? And that, I suppose, that'll be a bit of a watershed. That will be the sort of gateway into the finale of the race. And it may be, I know a lot of people, particularly after the results at the weekend, they think it's unlikely Tadej Pogacar will seek to blow the race apart as early as he did in Zurich last year. But it could be the point at which Slovenia really start to crank things, if they indeed are the team that are taking the race on. What do we think?
I think it's interesting because when you look at the going off the first circuit, it's from 134 to 176. That's sort of the off circuit before going into the last 6. It's going to be a very difficult race to control, and it's highly unlikely that a strong group will not go away before, because that's a lot of other people's chance, and they know that being a race of attrition, who is going to really be able to control if a fairly, I would say, like a group of 5, 8, 9 riders go away, because you're going to burn too many matches shutting that down. And I think the danger and the interesting part, aspect of this race is that if that group goes away with a decent gap before Mount Kigali and they can go into the finale, eventually there'll be a group of favorites going away, I think, on the climb. There's going to be a very, very interesting aspect to this race as to how big a gap a dangerous group is going to go into the final with. There will be a lot of pokering, I think. So there could be riders who are taking a chance who will end up in a very fortunate situation, I think, on this parcours.
You say it'll be very tactical, Brian. I see this as there'll be a lot of poker. I see this as quite an this could be a very untactical race because it's so hard.
No, the strongest rider, I mean, when it's that hard, the strongest rider is most likely to win, but it's still a 267 kilometer race. So even if you're strong, you still have to think about how you use your strengths. So, I mean, ultimately you can't do that much chasing more so than just upping the speed on the climbs and then see who's left. But you can't do that on, you know, 20 times on each time you go up a steep climb. Any strong rider will lose power that he'll need in the final. I think it's a dangerous course, thinking that, I'll open up at the back end of the last laps and then I'll be the world champion. I think a dangerous group will go away, and I think, you know, we've seen that happen in other worlds as well. You know, we've seen it happen that chaotic situations will arise. You know, the element of surprise in this parkour, I think, should not be underestimated, actually. I'm glad we disagree.
I think the real unpredictable element is just how patchy in terms of ability the field is going to be. And it's a relatively small start list as well. The provisional start list have got 165 riders on it. The big nations, the established nations that you would expect to have a full complement of riders have got 8 riders, or in the case of Slovenia, and they get an additional rider because Tadej Pogacar is the defending champion. But Australia, Belgium, Denmark, France, Italy, Spain and Great Britain are the teams that will line up with 8 riders. And then Eritrea and Rwanda have got 6 riders. And then Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands and USA have got 5 riders. Sorry, I think the Netherlands have got 6 riders as well. The others have got 5 riders. And so it's going to be, even more so than usual, it's going to be a race of kind of individuals coming to the fore from those teams, isn't it? In that kind of the second half of the race, because there's not going to be a lot of opportunities for teams to, you know, burn through resources chasing. It's not going to be the kind of course where they just ride something down. So, and there might not be the kind of the strength of breakaway at the start that might not kind of open the race out enough. if you like. You know, what will they do? Will they, you know, it depends who they let go early on, what sort of time gap they get. There needs to be some sort of catalyst. Otherwise, it's all going to be together at quite an early point in the race. And then I think it could be pretty chaotic. And we might see, you know, people trying their luck from a long, long way out, you know, either individually or in a small group. And, you know, it could be one of those world championships where really, as I said earlier, it's down to 20 riders, really quite a long way out. And we just see, you know, a clash of the strongest men on the day. And it becomes less about tactics and more about just, you know, who's going to take the risk at what point in the race.
Well, the thing is, you know, if because of how hard it is initially also with the first nine laps, you know, often you see in the world championships in the newer version, new iterations of the parkour, there's a run in before you come to the main laps. Here you have the main laps and then the off route to Mount Kigali and then back again to the last laps. But here, if the group is not strong enough, it has to be strong to be able to get a gap because you're straight on to the climbs. You're straight on to the lap that you'll then eventually finish up on. So if the group is not strong enough, they're not going to get a gap. They'll be caught straight away. You'll not have a group consisting of outside nations who will just, you know, try the luck and be, you know, in the TV break. Here, you'll have to have, say, if a group goes away proper after the first two, three laps, it'll have to be substantial riders. It'll have to be serious competitors for them to even be able to get a gap. So that's why I'm inclining towards thinking once we go into the laps before Mount Kigali, say after 100 kilometers, there could be an established group that will start to become dangerous if they have, I would say, maybe 5-6 minutes at the foot of Mount Kigali.
Yeah, I think one of the dangers for Pogacar is that a lot of riders in the field have reconciled themselves and the teams are reconciled to the fact that they can't beat him. And therefore, they'll be willing to stake everything on that early break and putting, you know, they might try to put three or four riders into a big early break. And in, much in the same way that we've seen Little Trek ride a lot recently and ride in the Vuelta, where they would use, I don't know, like a Carlos Verona to try to pull out, you know, in the first 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers to try and just really bury himself to get the team leader in the break as far down the road as possible. So get the break to sort of 4 or 5 minutes. I mean, this is highly, highly speculative. But I do think that rather than sort of back a leader who might be able to live with Pogacar in their minds later on, I think a lot of teams will go in resigned to the fact that they can't compete in that kind of race and they'll try something different, which might make for a really exciting race. Chaps, let's just indulge for a moment or two our best sort of beer mat theories on Pogacar, where he's at, what he'll do, what the time trial will mean for his performance on Sunday. I was just looking back. I think there's a bit of a misconception. There's a bit of recency bias. People imagine that after the Tour de France every year, he's come back and he's won everything every year. And his autumns have consisted of just consecutive clean sweeps of every race he's done. That's not really been the case. It was the case last year where he won pretty much everything he entered in the second part of the season. But in 2023, he didn't win after the Tour until Lombardy. In 2022, he DNF'd in San Sebastian. He was nowhere in Plouay. He won in Montreal in a sprint, and then he was pretty anonymous in the Worlds. And then in 2021, he didn't win after the Tour until Lombardy. So it's not sort of unusual for him to take a while to kind of warm, to settle into this last part of the season. There's another school of thought that last Sunday will have been useful in that it will be a bit of a warning to him that he can't be complacent and that he can't afford to attempt something like he did in Zurich last year, that he needs to be a bit more pragmatic. I think that's there's probably something to that, some substance to it. Another thing we should mention, and we'll run through some of the rivals in a minute, but Primoz Roglic is riding for Slovenia, and he's clearly taking the last part of the season very seriously because he's been pairing at altitude at Sierra Nevada, which I don't think that many riders have done, have gone to altitude specifically for this last part of the season. So that could be interesting to see how he gets on, particularly bearing in mind that from what I can hear, it's not a technical circuit at all. I think that will help Roglic. It will help Evenepoel as well. Not too many. Last year before Zurich, people were talking a lot about the number of accelerations that guys would have to do into corners, out of corners. There was a lot of that. I don't think there is on this course. Pogacar.
Interesting with Roglic. We'll get to that. Roglic wouldn't go on altitude camp to be a domestique for Pogacar. I don't believe that. But the pertinent element
already.
No, but you would have to agree. I'm sorry, but with Pogacar, that's an interesting thing. With the humble pie eating after the time trial, I like that. I think that that's the danger. I would be even more nervous than being a competitor, because if he doesn't do anything until say the last 40 kilometers, which is a very conservative approach for Pogacar, that's going to make for a very interesting race. That's yet to be seen, though, right? Him waiting that long in the 267-kilometer race. Be the latest attack he's done in a one-day race for a very long time.
I mean, unless he's having a breakfast of humble pie birthday cake on Sunday. I mean, all of the ingredients are there for him, aren't they? It's a classic race length. It's a grand tour stage in terms of elevation. The altitude, I mean, that could be a factor. Riders all react slightly differently to altitude. Again, Daniel, as you said, depending on how long they've been there, what they've done to prepare, whether they've acclimatized enough for it. It's high enough to be a factor, isn't it? 1500 meters, certainly. But I do think that the ingredients are there to make him the number one favorite for the race, but that doesn't mean that he can, clear a space in his suitcase for another rainbow jersey just yet. He's going to have to, as you say, Daniel, I think just ride as much with the head as the legs this Sunday, because everyone will expect him to pull out the 50 kilometer or more attacks that he's made his trademark. And so they'll be alert for that and may well have plans to try and counter that. And he mentioned Lidl Trek. I think Lidl Trek are the only team that's got almost as many riders in the field as UAE Team Emirates have. I suppose the tricky one for Pogacar would be if, say, a Mexican and a Portuguese and a Spaniard and a Frenchman and an Australian all got up the road with 60K to go, and it turned out that it was Jay Vine, Pavel Sivakov, Del Toro, Morgado, Jan Christen, Switzerland.
Gorschatner.
I always say this, it is quite interesting watching, especially when these little breaks form, and seeing what the trade team alliances are. I'm not saying that it's the number one sort of layer of intrigue in a world championship road race, but it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, if you get three riders away on the last two laps, and it's three UAE riders or three Lidl Trek riders, I mean,
we're due one of these, aren't we, Lionel? We haven't had one of these. These used to be a regular occurrence, particularly in the MAPE years, but we haven't had a really good sort of trade team versus national team beef since Florence and Rui Costa, Valverde, and all of that. Valverde, of course, is a Spanish team coach for this World Championship. Chaps, I'm just going to run down quickly some of the other favourites. Of course, we've got Remco Evenepoel. He's probably my tip to win, to be honest. Remco Evenepoel. We've got for GB, Oscar Onley, Tom Pidcock, Del Toro, of course. Ayuso, who's been talking in the press about how he is there. He's in Rwanda to ride for the rainbow jersey. Valverde has been a bit more cagey. He said he'd sign for a medal. The Australians, Hindley, Vine, Soler for the Spaniards. I feel as though if it's a chaotic race, then only one man can win, Mark Soler. Jan Christen, UAE rider. He'll be interesting with Mark Hirsch in the Swiss team. Bernal Schelmoser for the Danes. Brian, Ben Healy, Carapaz, Alaphilippe. Sivakov, you've mentioned, Lionel, Bagioli for the Italians. This is a very random list, by the way. And finally, last but certainly not least, probably the outstanding favourite, Larry Warbus of the USA. Can you stoop to making a prediction? Can you lower yourself, Lionel?
I think you've probably got the two outstanding favourites there, haven't you? Tadej Pogačar and Remco Evenepoel. I mean, that's not really a surprise, is it? I think it will come down to a showdown between those two plus a sort of small handful of others in that in that finale. I think Ben Healy is a good shout to be in there. I think, you know, one of Jai Hindley or Jay Vine for Australia. And I think Tom Pidcock
as
well.
You have to have Del Toro. You have to have Del Toro,
of course.
Medal.
Yeah, Del Toro as well. Yeah, I think
the way he's going. I would have him right below Evenepoel and Pogačar with the way he's going. I suppose the distances might not be in his favor, but he is
hasn't done a lot over that sort of distance, has he?
But that doesn't prove the opposite, though, right?
No, but tippy-tappy Italian sort of semi-classics, a good gauge of potential for the World Championship. I'm not sure, Brian. I'm not sure. Ask Mark Hirschi.
Del Toro was 13th at Milan
San Remo. Don't compare to Mark Hirschi.
But you couldn't get a more different 260-80-kilometer race this, could you? I mean, Milan San Remo is not a comparison, but I mean,
Milan San Remo and Daniel Freiber predictions, just to throw that in, spanner in the wheel.
What have you got to say about that? I can't even remember the reference. Mine is Remco Pogacar second. And then I think you're along the right line. I think a climber, possibly a climber who's come out of the Vuelta. I think a sort of more of a Grand Tour rider, a kind of Jai Hindley or even an Egan Bernal, someone like that in third. And I'm discounting Del Toro. Brian?
I have Pogačar as the outright favorite. I have a group of podium candidates, and that obviously includes Evenepoel and Del Toro and actually Skelmose. He's a great championship rider. He is good on the distance. He's a good finisher. And I think he's quite good at also saving his energy. You can't, looking at the Vuelta, as strange as it was, anyone with that type of climbing volume coming out of that race will be a factor. They'll have a completely different way in and absorbing the first 170, 80 kilometers. It'll be way different type of race for them. So they'll be there just by the fact of what they've been through. So, yeah.
But then also
The element of surprise that I still believe in.
And there'll be somebody who has, they will have six riders in a group of 20. And then when it whittles down to a group of 8 or 10, they'll have nobody. There'll be somebody that just looks like, I don't know, 40, 50K out, or perhaps a bit further out, looks like, oh, they've got this race by the scruff of the neck. They've got everybody exactly where they want them. And then they just evaporate, melt away. Happens to somebody more or less every year, doesn't it? I'm not going to hazard a guess at who it is, but we'll look out for that and see who gets the what would he call it, the evaporation prize, the evaporating jersey. I don't know.
Well, chaps, we shall see. I mean, my firm conviction is that this World Championships will be remembered for some kind of Walter Mitty type narrative involving Valerio Alessandri. No aspersions on Valerio Alessandri of Nauru, but I'm sure there's something about this story that tells me there's some.
No, that's a kilometer zero.
I don't know. There's something smells vaguely fishy. Anyway, we will find out. We'll report back on the exploits of our good friend Valerio Alessandri on Sunday in an Arrivé, Lionel, isn't it?
Yes, an episode of Arrivé on Saturday for the women's race with Rose. And then Daniel and I will be here on Sunday to pick over the bones of the men's road race and see who it was who takes home the rainbow jersey and gets to wear it for the next year.
Lionel, thank you. And thank you, Brian. Just finally, I just want to say thank you to all the people who have contacted us with nice remarks. I think some in response to my kind of self-pitying lament about the abuse I'd got in the final episode of our Vuelta coverage, the abuse I'd got for our coverage of political goings-on, shall we say, at the Vuelta a España. But I've had a lot of nice comments, really thoughtful and kind comments on various platforms, be it Strava, Twitter, Instagram, all sorts. So thank you. I have tried to respond to everyone, but if I haven't responded, then a further thank you here. On that note, thank you, Lionel, and thank you, Brian.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.